Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call with you today, live from Miami, from the offices of LATAM Investments through the studios of Progressive Radio Network in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very much of a landmark broadcast to you today. I have expressed a need to speak to you about a turning point in my thinking about the current economy and the United States in general, and I'm going to share that with you today. It has been gestating in my mind for many months, and my wife and I have discussed it at great length, and we have decided that sometime this year we will move to Singapore. Now, this is a decision not taken lightly. My wife is American. She's from Southern California. I came over from Europe 20 years ago. I'd spent the best part of 20 years in the United States with an extended periods outside. And I must tell you that this is not the country that I signed up for 20 years ago. Now, a lot of what I say will be very uncomfortable for many of you. You may wish to ask yourselves whether this is a program that you want to listen to. Many of you will be deeply offended by what I have to say. Let me say right now at the outset that this is not an attack on individual Americans. It is an attack on the American way of life. It is an attack on the very premise by which this country was founded back in the late 18th century. I must tell you straight off that my view, which has been formulated for many years about the American way of life and the American economy, is that it is unworkable. America is a grand experiment, which was the issue of many years of oppression felt by Europeans who came over here. And the founding fathers formulated a way of life hastily, without much reference to what had gone before, and in my view, quite erroneously. I will come on to this later on in the broadcast. I will talk about the history of the way in which America has formulated its existence today. But suffice it to say for the moment that the system, in my opinion, is unworkable. It is the result of many years of an experiment which has gone awry over the last 20 years financially and over the last 40 years economically, because America was not founded on sound principles of economics. And again, we'll talk about that later. My advice straight away to all of you is that you may want to consider whether you would not wish to emigrate. This is as a result of a visionary approach that I hold, which is that America will become chaotic in about 3 or 4 years' time. I have a lot of eminent people on my side here in support of this theory. But this would be the time for those of you who have ever felt that you could make a life for yourselves on a distant shore. It sounds very scary to begin with. It sounds very confronting until you realize that grand migrations have been a regular occurrence throughout history. The Roman Empire sent many of its folk abroad to run the colonies. It afforded them new opportunities to pay less taxes and in many sense to liberate themselves from an oppressive regime in the idea that they could form something new and dynamic and different. In the same way, you had the great migrations from England to New England between 1630 and 1640, for reasons actually which were much less economic than what I fear will happen here. They were to do much more with religious freedom. Of course, economics played a major role, but those who stayed did suffer in consequence. In other words, the decision of the migrants was well-founded, and incontestably, 100 years on, the Americans had a much better way of life and a much better standard of living than they did in the old Europe. We have the example of the Jewish emigrants to North and South America in the 30s as a result of oppression in Germany, and then, of course, to Israel in the 1950s. Giant migrations of people who simply looked at each other over, for example, a dining table and said, we have to go. This is the time when we need to make a move. In many cases, especially in Germany, the Jewish inhabitants had an excellent way of life. They owned very successful businesses. They were at the apex of their personal success. And yet, they decided that they had to leave. Looking at yet another example, at the time of partition in 1947 in India, 17.9 million people left their homes in the great transmigration between India and the new Pakistan. This was economic, it was political, it was religious, it was much more clearly defined as a needy move on the part of each and every one of the migrants, and it was not at all without costly bloodshed. In fact, fully 3 million of those 17.9 million were never accounted for. They never, as it were, arrived. Today, nearly 190 million people, or 3% of the world's population, lives outside their country of birth. That's from a New York Times report in 2002. All right, well, I want you to be reassured, ladies and gentlemen, that my wake-up call from Singapore will remain constant. I will put in an application with the powers that be for a change of time. 1 a.m. in the morning doesn't seem like a very good time for anybody to be making a wake-up call. I'd rather not wake up, quite frankly. I'd rather do it at 7 a.m. Singapore time, which would be 7 p.m. Eastern time, or at 7 p.m. Eastern Singapore time, which would be 7 a.m. Eastern time. But those are details which we will work out, and rest assured that I will be alive and well on the show, as always, twice a week. Now, what I would like to do is to show you why I believe it is that the downward path upon which America is embarked is irreversible. It cannot find its feet as it did in the Great Depression. The United States as a country has basically embarked on an economically suicidal mission of impoverishment, which is, of course, accompanied by absolute apathy on the part of the American people, which is a major reason why I cannot possibly consider that the country will have any kind of salvation which will bring it back to its former economic glory in the next couple of generations at least. Just to give you a couple of examples, there was a bill voted in, the EESATARP bill, recently, which obligated American citizens to pay $700 billion in taxes that they do not have. That's to say, putting them in debt by another $700 billion. This bill was opposed at a ratio of 100 to 1, up as far as 300 to 1 in calls, faxes, and letters to Congress. It was passed over those objections, ladies and gentlemen, with an election less than 1 month away. And we, the people, then returned 90% of those who voted yes and stood for re-election for office. Well, George Bush, as I'm sure you all recall, lied to the Americans about weapons of mass destruction. This fact was fully known to the people before the 2004 elections. Yet he swept in by a majority which could not possibly be explained by mere fraud. You know, when you look at the people who run this country, the boomers, look at the profile of these people. Boomers spent their entire lives arguing with their parents, starting with the massive demonstrations and riots in the 1960s and 70s. They have no idea how to manage or to lead. They have lost the position of America to Asia and to other countries who have taken up where America has quite simply left off. Their parents and grandparents took care of everything for them, and all they did was criticize. Their parents told them what to do. They whined and argued, but in the end, they did it. Now that the parents are gone, the boomers are senior managers in organizations all over the country, and they still have no idea how to manage or to lead. They're still waiting for someone else to tell them what to do. And then you have the Gen Xer generation. And the boomers are looking to the Gen Xers to tell them what to do. You know, you have nihilistic, contemptuous, greedy Gen Xers working for stupid, compliant, greedy boomers. The Xers reject all the accomplishments that came before, and the boomers go along with them. And you only have to look at the current economic decision-making by the government to see how they are absolutely being led upon a path of blindness and stupidity, doing the precise opposite of what needs to be done in order to get this country back on its feet. You see, the problem is the way in which this country has formulated itself, has organized itself on economic and indeed on social lines. Now, I'll be talking a lot about the historical context of this later on in the show. But, I mean, take the example of the government organizers, the people in government, the Congress people who are supposed to make the laws in the best interests of the company. Just look at the concept of these people. You can read any tome on corporate management that you come up against and find that a dozen or so is the maximum number of contributors who can make a corporation or a government work. Any board of directors bigger than that has major problems in getting agreements and in accomplishing anything. As far as a government of several hundred people doing anything coordinated, forget about it. No bureaucracy, whether government, corporate, or whatever, can ever see beyond the next election, board meeting, or whatever. Therefore, they never have the ability to make the changes which would benefit the organization in the long run. See, here's the bitter truth. Democracy cannot work. Spending $1 billion to get elected to a job paying less than $500,000 is the ultimate indication that there is some potential for influence peddling and corruption. There should have been a bigger middle class in the United States and Canada. Both countries need at least twice as many in manufacturing. The Asians, and by the way, I'm not intending this maliciously or personally, have destroyed the United States economy, not so much by buying all its manufacturing equipment, and whose fault was that, but by selling $3 items that cause them to have a service economy that replaces this at a cost of $100 or even much more. Service economies help the circulation but do nothing to the real GDP. Just as an extra 50,000 new government hires, otherwise unemployed due to immigration pressures, only provide a drag on the real economy. You know, the argument goes that the United States still graduates the best science and engineering doctorates. By the way, I'm not sure who number two is, but it's not even close. This is based on the number and quality of peer-reviewed journal articles in the world literature. The vast majority of the frontline research is done in the U.S. If some other country is graduating more people with PhD after their name, that may be, even if the training and achievement levels are not yet equivalent, foreign countries, particularly Asian ones, are fast catching up. Half of U.S. doctorate science and engineering students are foreign-born, and the overwhelming majority return to their home countries after graduating. This did not used to be the case. In the last 25 years, drastic changes have transpired with regards to the United States' stature, both economically and geopolitically. Whereas the United States produced more than half science and engineering doctorates and one-third of all college students, those numbers are now down to one-fourth and one-tenth, respectively, today. It should come as no surprise that the United States is no longer the epicenter of innovation. Japan and Korea now lead in patent filings per person, where it was the United States 30 years ago. Pharma and tech are no longer exclusive U.S. points of origin. Even Hollywood and the U.S. network cable television no longer holds the dominance they once did. 25 years ago, there wasn't even a whisper about the predominant position of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And what happened in 2008? Mumbai and Mexico City residents demanded payments in their native currencies in lieu of dollars. The premier U.S. growth industries over the last 5 years were real estate and finance. The chief U.S. export during that time was IOUs, whichever combination of debt, CDs, securitization paper thereof you care to cite. The number is in the region of $20 trillion or so. All right, well now, ladies and gentlemen, let's move on to the real reason why my wife and I are leaving and why I feel that it is in the best interests of those of you who feel that they could make a move to do so. I believe that we are about to see a wave of drastic social and civil unrest. You know, not so long ago, most people would have scoffed at the notion that the United States might experience the sort of turbulence and upheaval that has been common in banana republics or ailing first world nations. A recent report produced by the U.S. Army War College's Strategic Institute warns that the United States may experience massive civil unrest in the wake of a series of crises which it has termed strategic shock. The report titled Known Unknowns, Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development, also suggests that the military may have to be used to quell domestic disorder. And I quote a report authored by Colonel Nathan Freer. Widespread civil violence inside the United States would force the defense establishment to reorient priorities in extremis to defend basic domestic order and human security. Deliberate employment of weapons of mass destruction or other catastrophic capabilities, unforeseen economic collapse, loss of functioning political and legal order, purposeful domestic resistance or insurgency, pervasive public health emergencies, and catastrophic natural and human disasters are all paths to destructive domestic shock. An American government and defense establishment lulled into complacency by a long-secure domestic order would be forced to rapidly divest some or most external security commitments in order to address rapidly expanding human insecurity at home. Already predisposed to defer to the primacy of civilian authorities in instances of domestic security and divest all but the most extreme demands in areas like civil support and consequence management, the Department of Defense might be forced by circumstances to put its broad resources at the disposal of civil authorities to contain and reverse violent threats to domestic tranquility. Under the most extreme circumstances, this might include use of military force against hostile groups inside the United States. Freer, by the way, is a senior fellow in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joined the think tank in April 2008 after retiring from the U.S. Army after 20 years as a lieutenant colonel. He also warns that we have recently highlighted plans to station thousands more U.S. troops inside America for purposes of domestic security from September 2011 in expansion of NORTHCOM's militarization of the country in preparation for potential civil unrest following a total economic collapse or a mass terror attack. Now, I want to make it very clear, ladies and gentlemen, I do not get involved in theories of conspiracies and other forms of what if this might happen or this has been heard to be said type of doctrines. I am only interested in what I know, in what has been said by important and powerful people, and for myself formulating a conclusion as to where it will all lead. The International Monetary Fund Managing Director Dominic Strauss-Kahn warned recently of economy-related riots and unrest in various global markets if the financial crisis is not addressed and lower-income households are hurt by credit constraints and rising unemployment. U.S. Senator James Inhofe and Brad Sherman both said U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson brought up a worst-case scenario as he pushed for the Wall Street bailout in September. Paulson, a former Goldman Sachs CEO, said that that might even require a declaration of martial law. State and local police in Arizona say they have broad plans to deal with social unrest, including trouble resulting from economic distress. The security and police agencies declined to give specifics, but said they would employ existing and generalized emergency responses to civil unrest that arises for any reason. And I quote Phoenix police spokesman Andy Hill. The Phoenix Police Department is not expecting any civil unrest at this time, but we always train to prepare for any civil unrest issue. We have a tactical response unit that trains continually and has deployed on many occasions for any potential civil unrest issue. Scottsdale Police spokesman Mark Clark said, "We have well-established plans in place for such civil unrest." In the short term, the domestic deployment of troops is likely aimed at combating likely civil unrest that will ensue after a complete economic collapse followed by a devastated period of hyperinflation. This warning, by the way, was echoed again a few days ago in a leaked internal memo from Citibank. And I quote Tom Fitzpatrick, Citibank's chief technical strategist. The world is not going back to normal after the magnitude of what they have done. When the dust settles, this will either work and the money they have pushed into the system will feed through into an inflation shock. The memo predicts, quote, depression, civil disorder, and possibly wars as a fallout from an economic collapse that many say is on the horizon. And do you think it is illegal to use the army to quell rioting within the borders of the United States? Well, Section 1385 of the Posse Comitatus Act states, and I quote, whoever, except in cases and under circumstances expressly authorized by the Constitution or Act of Congress, willfully uses any part of the army or the Air Force as a posse comitatus or otherwise to execute the laws shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. End of quote. Under the John Warner Defense Authorization Act, signed by President Bush on October the 17th, 2006, the law was changed to state, quote, the President may employ the armed forces to restore public order in any state of the United States the President determines hinders the execution of laws or deprives people of a right, privilege, immunity, or protection named in the Constitution and secured by law, or opposes or obstructs the execution of the laws of the United States or impedes the course of justice under those laws. End of quote. Now, those changes were repealed in their entirety by H.R. 4986, the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2008, reverting back to the original state of the Insurrection Act of 1807. Despite this repeal, President Bush attached a signing statement saying that he did not feel bound by the repeal. It remains to be seen whether President-elect Obama will reverse Bush's signing statement. Well, the United Nations report on the urban environment, which came out very recently, states that growing inequality in U.S. cities could lead to widespread social unrest and increased mortality. In a survey of 120 major cities, New York was found to be the ninth most unequal in the world, and Atlanta, Georgia, New Orleans, Louisiana, Washington, D.C., and Miami, Florida had similar inequality levels to those of Nairobi, Kenya, and Abidjan, Ivory Coast. Many were above an internationally recognized acceptable alert line used to warn governments. And I quote from the report, high levels of inequality can lead to negative social, economic, and political consequences that have a destabilizing effect on societies. They create social and political fractures that can develop into social unrest and insecurity. According to the annual State of the World Cities report from UN Habitat, race is one of the most important factors determining levels of inequality in the US and Canada. The life expectancy of African Americans in the U.S. is about the same as that of people living in China and some states of India, despite the fact that the U.S. is far richer than those two countries, it said. And I continue to quote, it is clear that social tension comes from inequality. The trickle-down theory, that wealth starts with the rich, has not delivered. Inequality is not good for anybody, said Anna Tibaijuka, head of the UN Habitat in London. Well, I was reading from the first European website of political anticipation, independent from any government body, owned by a consortium of prestigious policy and strategic interests, and it's called the Laboratoire Européen d'Anticipation Politique, or LEAP. And they have come out with one of their Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin reports. And I read from the report, as described previously by LEAP-E 2020, the epicenter of the global systemic crisis is in the U.S., collapsing pillar of the global order. For this reason, the impact of this crisis is a lot more violent and enduring than anywhere else in the world. For instance, the bursting of the housing bubble is provoking the sudden impoverishment of millions of American citizens whose houses are foreclosed. Each month, foreclosures double, leading dozens of millions of U.S. citizens, women and children who live in the foreclosed houses, to end up on the street or to find new homes in the worst conditions. The ongoing recession creates unemployment concealed by the official statistics, by the way, the same statistics which negated that a housing bubble was bursting or that there was subprime crisis as long as they could, but nevertheless driving millions of Americans, the same ones most often, to the street. This being so, the crisis is beginning to hit middle classes, sometimes even above that, as in the case of the Wall Street layoffs. The drop of house prices today affects all categories of U.S. households who used their house mortgage to finance their lifestyle, i.e. a large majority of Americans. They are now rushing on their credit cards at a prohibitive cost to avoid downgrading too much their way of life. But it is a short-term solution. Social unrest has in fact started, and it aggravates each day. LEAP-E 2020 wishes to remind that without a general social protection, the impact of an economic recession in the U.S. is socially terrible. The magnitude of this crisis, combining house collapse, economic recession, inflation of consuming goods and imported energy via U.S. dollar weakness, all this together with a political blockade in Washington provides the background for a regime crisis. The so-called Very Great Depression is already triggered in the U.S., and according to LEAP-E 2020, it will result before the end of 2009 in a regime crisis in the U.S. where the army will play an important role. Now, let me conclude this part of my talk today, ladies and gentlemen, with a few quotes from Gerald Celente, who has been on Gary's show a number of times, I believe, including once very recently. His ability to forecast and predict is, as far as I know, quite unrivaled among current forecasters. And he has this to say. All levels of government will be caught up in the private sector collapse as tax bases shrink and tax revenues sharply decline. Attempts to make up shortfalls by raising taxes, tuition and tolls, and imposing higher user and license fees will do little to resolve the problems, but will do a lot to infuriate citizens. Now, I should tell you that this comes from Celente's Trends Journal report, which comes out four times a year, and this is from the winter issue 2009. And I continue to quote. Immediately following the November elections, the sale of safes and guns rose dramatically. While at the moment such measures may seem extreme, as Great Depression conditions set in, crime will rise and self-protection in all its aspects will become a major trend. Petty thieves, con artists, muggers, burglars, kidnappers, street gangs, organized criminals, in addition to Wall Street and Washington, will be on the prowl. From bulletproof vests and advanced security systems to rent a bodyguard and burglar-proof money mattresses, The anti-theft field will attract resourceful and no doubt outlandish innovators. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in case you think that that is merely academic, may I let you know that my car was broken into on Saturday night and my wife's purse was stolen along with all her credit cards, keys, other forms of credit, merchant card offers worth several hundred dollars. This is no academic joyride. And I continue to quote from Salenti. Never in its history has American fallen so low and so fast after riding so high. And we forecast it will fall much further and land harder than almost any place in the world. The vital America seen by the outside world, with its can-do spirit, is a vestige of its old self, and what is left of it is under siege. Individualism, entrepreneurship, and the pioneering spirit are being rendered irrelevant by big government and big business. Every decision made by the government to partner with a Wall Street firm or big business was done without the consent and or was against the wishes of the public, the very people who will be forced to pay for it. It is a matter of historical fact. When people are homeless, helpless, desperate, jobless, and hungry, sooner or later they will rebel. And it won't be any different in America. Americans have been seduced into believing economic conditions will never deteriorate enough to provoke open rebellion, and that these things only happen in other countries, usually the Third World. The media can be counted on to miss the initial signs and deny them even when they become undeniable. But regardless of what the media sees or says, over the course of 2009, the first sporadic salvos of what will become the revolution of 2012 will have been fired. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I remind you that this comes from Gerald Salenti, who has an unparalleled record of correct predictions. So there you have it. That is the background to the decision of my wife and myself to leave the United States and to take up permanent residence elsewhere. There is a book called The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe that talks about an excellent case which can be made that the U.S. is approaching another time of secular crisis. You might want to read the book. It is actually very interesting. There's no way of telling where the crisis will lead or how it will end. That's going to depend not only on exactly who's in control, but what they do, whom they're up against, and 100 other variables we can't even anticipate. One thing that seems certain is that real crisis brings out strong, although not necessarily wise, leadership. Because of its age and size, it will come from the boomer generation, and it will be in the mold of Roosevelt or Lincoln, both very dangerous precedents. The boomers in elderhood will be dogmatic, harsh, puritanical, and quite willing to burn down the barn in order to destroy whatever rats they see. Admix that attitude to a time resembling the Revolution, the Civil War, or World War II, overlay with today's ethnic strife, urbanization, financial overextension, and powerful compact new weaponry in the hands of foreign fanatics out to teach the great Satan a lesson, and it's a real witch's brew. If things evolve over the next decade as they did in past analogs, it will be a very unmellow time indeed. That's assuming things end well, and there's no guarantee they will, as many foreign countries have discovered throughout history. The U.S. has been uniquely blessed. Strauss and Howe aren't exactly financial types, and their advice is nebulous along those lines. But to sum it up, their suggestion is to learn to swim with the tide by not hoping the current good times last forever. The chances of the good times are coming to an end now. And they'd also advise not sticking your head up above the crowd, something that is always very risky when times are in turmoil. Remember what happened to Japanese Americans during the last crisis. They suggest that there will likely be a resurgence of nationalism, much as was the case during past crises. It will not be a good time to be a maverick in the United States. Strauss and Howe suggest that you look to diversify in all things, so everything won't go bad at once. Brace for the collapse of public support mechanisms. Set your roots with your family, because people you can rely on will be at a premium. Heed emerging community norms. Bond with like-minded people and return to basic classic virtues. This is, of course, sound advice any time, but critical if you're rigging for heavy weather. Well, if you do want to stay in the U.S., you'd rather be on some land near a small town and far away from a major city, I should think. You'd want to be self-sufficient in as many ways as possible, sort of things like freeze-dried food. Well, let's move on to the economic wherewithal here, the rationale for moving out of the United States. As I wrote in what I called a quote of the day to my email subscribers earlier today, we now require about $5 of debt to generate $1 of GDP. This, of course, is unsustainable. It has to end. And frankly, given all I've said so far and all I have to say, I don't think I want to be around here when it does. You know, once you reach a level where a dollar in debt will not support a dollar in GDP, you must inevitably either pay down or default that excess debt. Unfortunately, in this case, we must pay down or default approximately 80% of the aggregate public and private debt in the United States in order to return to a standard where $1 in debt will generate $1 in GDP. Defaulting or paying down less will turn the clock back to a degree, but does not change the ultimate outcome. Only returning to $1 of debt, returning $1 or more of GDP, and holding the total level of debt outstanding at or below that level results in a stable monetary system. The monetary and banking system is inherently unstable until and unless this is done, and as the zero point is approached, it becomes more and more unstable, producing more and more violent dislocations. This is why every crisis since 1968 has been more serious and required larger and more intrusive interventions to calm, including the 1970s, 80s energy shocks and inflation crisis, the 1987 market dislocation, the LTCM crisis, the tech implosion, and now the credit bubble, housing crash. The absolute worst thing you can do when in the hole like this is to spend even more on a deficit basis, thereby driving the debt ratio higher and return per dollar of debt in GDP lower. The last 8 years have been disastrous in this regard. The truth is that the TARP, EESA, and other stimulus and record rescue packages, which now total more than $1.6 trillion, have dramatically tightened the spiral. The $7 trillion in new lending capacity, if it was put into the market and utilized, might well push the aggregate rate of return for $1 in debt below zero. That is, force it to a negative rate of return. Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson know this, which is why they didn't propose that solution and why they didn't force the bankers under law to lend out the recapitalization that they provided. When they reach the point where a dollar of debt has a negative impact on GDP, the United States monetary system and government will implode. The reason for this is mathematically obvious. Each additional dollar of borrowing beyond that point actually contracts GDP instead of growing it. That is, for all intents and purposes, a black hole. It is that event that has led to the implosion of other monetary systems, such as the hyperinflationary implosion of Argentina. Debt that cannot be serviced must be defaulted. While it sounds counterintuitive, the bad mortgages must foreclose, not be reworked. All of them. House prices must fall to no more than 3.5 times incomes on a median basis. Now, this information, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, comes courtesy of Carl Denninger, and you might want to go to his website, market-ticker.denninger.net, for more information. He's a very prescient commentator, and usually he comes up trumps every time he tackles the subject, and he has not failed us in this regard either. And a couple more things that he says here. Neither Treasury or the Fed has a clue as to what they're doing. Now, we knew this. I've told you this over and over again. The SEC's Chris Cox and various members of Congress have confirmed this repeatedly, stating clearly that both Bernanke and Paulson have come to them with demands for immediate action, backed by outrageous claims of immediate collapse of the entire financial system, martial law, or both, if they do not acquiesce to their demands, even though less than a month prior, and for the previous year, these same people were claiming that our economic issues were contained. The only possible explanation for this behavior is that these two men were and are incompetent, insane, panicked and unable to think clearly, concerned that their complicity in this mess is about to be exposed, and it will end very badly for them, or all of the above. President Obama has threatened to spend more than $1 trillion in stimulus. But in fact, the nation doesn't have that $1 trillion. You cannot go further into debt to avoid the consequences arises from excessive debt in the first place. If President Obama doesn't realize this fact and change course before he and Congress spend this money, the odds of that 50% contraction go up precipitously. The $1 trillion expenditure alone will backload yet another 5% onto the GDP contraction that must come. This, ladies and gentlemen, is an act of pure lunacy. And yet it appears to be precisely what the government intends to do. You want to know why the fraudsters, including everyone screaming to be bailed out of their ill-conceived schemes, are winning? It is because Americans refuse to complain vociferously enough, even though very effective and fully peaceful means of demonstrating and demanding change, constitutionally protected means of expression that would have vast and immediate effect, exist. You know? Americans are consenting as individuals and as a nation to the economic rape being served upon them by the scams and the schemes of the few. You know, debt taken to finance consumption has zero positive long-term impact on the economy. When debt is taken to pay existing debt, it has the potential to result in catastrophic economic collapse. This is what Americans have been doing for the last 30 years. You cannot solve an addiction problem with more of what the addict is hooked on, whether it be booze, crack, meth, or debt. It's not credit. It's debt. Do not listen to the nonsense handed out on CNBC and in the media. When someone you talk to says credit, stop them right there and correct them. The monetary system in America is debt-based. The more liquidity they pump, the more debt is taken on. Have you ever seen an addict cured by giving them more of their favorite drug? Debt must be repaid with interest. It therefore must deflate the monetary base, since interest is a non-productive charge against income and thus earnings. This, by the way, is the fatal flaw in Bernanke's doctoral thesis. By refusing to recognize that all modern monetary systems, including ours, are debt-based, he also fails to recognize that there are limits to being able to print your way out of a deflation, since what you are printing is in fact debt, and eventually you reach an inflection point where the spiral tightens. That is, the more printing you do, the worse the problem gets. This country has been falsely claiming growth that didn't actually occur for more than 20 years. This is why your wages have been stagnant, while everything you need to buy has gone up in price, and for most Americans, their standard of living has contracted. FDR was widely hailed as a hero. He was no such thing. FDR's policies, in fact, caused a second wave of depression after the original downdraft that originated in 1929. This is not commonly reported, but it is, in fact, true. There was a second, nearly 20% contraction in GDP that occurred as a direct consequence of FDR's policies. Repeating what FDR did to any material degree will not help, and any apparent relief will be false. Well, again, refer yourselves to Carl Denninger and market-ticker.geninger.net. Excellent information from there. All right, so finally, let me talk a little bit about what I think is the historical context of the United States, which basically, I think, set the stage for the kind of permanent collapse that this country is going to be subject to in the future. You know, the 13 original colonies were actually individual countries. Now, many people don't realize this. They were as individual as France and Germany or Korea and Afghanistan. They were owned by the United Kingdom. But please remember that all the African countries that gained their independence, like the United States, did so as independent countries. And, you know, they didn't unite in this country into a single state until under the current constitution adopted in 1787 by the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, was ratified by the individual colonies. And it was only on March the 4th, 1789, that the U.S. government under the Constitution began operations. Patrick Henry of Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death fame and other far-sighted statesmen bitterly opposed the unification of the 13 individual independent colonies into a single entity on grounds that that would lead to an oppressive dictatorial government which the colonies, then so happy to join, would not be free to leave. Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War, the world's most horrific bloodbath until World War I, producing a conquered and essentially colonized South as its legacy for 100 years, proved Patrick Henry right. Now, understand this. The Americans who protested against British encroachments on colonial liberties wanted to preserve their traditional rights. They were not revolutionaries seeking the radical restructuring of society. Colonial spokesmen possessed a breathtaking command of British history and law. They used the word innovation pejoratively, as in John Adams's Braintree Instructions of 1765 that held Parliament's new taxes were an unconstitutional innovation. They were well aware of the celebrated British documents to which they could appeal in their defense, particularly the Magna Carta, the Petition of Right, and the Bill of Rights. The controversy surrounding the Stamp Act of 1765 is instructive. Designed as a revenue measure for the British government, the Act required that a wide variety of paper products in colonies, from legal deeds to newspapers and tavern licenses to will, bear revenue stamps indicating in each case that this new tax had been paid. From the American point of view, such taxation without consent was an intolerable novelty. And when modern-day liberals justify extremely broad readings of the Constitution on the grounds that we need a living, breathing Constitution that changes with the times, they are actually recommending the very system the colonists sought to escape. The British Constitution was very flexible indeed, too flexible for the colonists, who were inflexibly committed to upholding their traditional rights. The living, breathing British Constitution was no safeguard of American liberties. And you see, the problem is that because of the fractured nature of this country, which is based directly in the Constitution of the United States, you see all kinds of different and aleatory forms of government and laws which are being voted in different states, which directly contradict each other. And this is very partly the problem as to why Americans are not cohesively formed into a united front against a government which is doing them harm. You know, the anti-federalists, who were not frivolous men, raised prescient criticisms about the Constitution. Patrick Henry was concerned that the general welfare clause would someday be interpreted to authorize practically any federal power that might be imagined. Others feared that the taxing power would prove an instrument of tyranny in the hands of the new government. Still others feared the power of the judicial branch, whose pronouncements on the meaning of the Constitution may well run counter to common understanding of the framers, but against whom the people would have little recourse. That the anti-federalists may have been onto something should be evident from a casual glance at the federal government today, which is not exactly the modest institution scrupulously confining itself to its enumerated powers that the framers intended. And please remember that the First Amendment also did not allow federal interference in state questions involving speech and press. You know, an example of how the states have had its momentum and the economically catastrophic decisions made for them taken over by the federal government comes throughout the many conflicts since World War II, where the United States has not officially declared war once since then, including the cases of Korea and Vietnam. Sometimes the president has simply sent men into battle without consulting Congress at all. Other times, there have been cowardly and unconstitutional congressional resolutions authorizing the president to use military force if and how he deems necessary. Congress has no power under the Constitution to delegate its war-making power to the president, which is precisely what it is doing when it authorizes him to take whatever action he thinks necessary, including the use of force abroad. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may think this is all quite irrelevant, but I assure you that it seeps in like a cancer in every aspect of the way in which the federal government treats the states today. This country would have been far better off, frankly, as 50 independent countries. It would not be suffering the indignities that it is suffering today at the hands of the federal government. And I would like to talk more about this, but I fear that we are out of time, because there's a lot in the historical context that you need to know in order to be able to piece the jigsaw together. Because this is not happenstance. The way in which your country has come undone is not a function of people who mean badly and are trying to disrupt the way in which this country is governed and run. It is a direct consequence of the historical anomaly of the way in which this country was set up in the first place. Well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid that we have come to an end of this hour. It has not been a pleasure to say these things to you, and I hope you will forgive me. We will leave the subject right there, and we will be back to regularly scheduled programming as of Thursday. And I thank you very much for listening. This is, again, Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, wishing you all a very happy and successful 2009. I'll be back with you at Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Bye-bye till then.